Well, hello and welcome to the first episode of COVIDcast, a Lowy Institute pop-up podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effect of coronavirus on global politics. My name is Michael Fullilove and I'm the Executive Director of the Lowy Institute. And each week for the next few weeks, we'll sit down with Lowy Institute experts to discuss the implications of coronavirus for the world. Now, this podcast is not the place to come to for health advice. If you're after that kind of thing, we recommend you visit the Department of Health website, which is issuing daily updates. Novel coronavirus, which causes the disease now known as COVID-19, emerged in December 2019 in the city of Wuhan in Hubei province in the People's Republic of China. And the virus and its attendant effects have spread quickly throughout the world. As of today, there are a total of 93,000 reported cases of coronavirus globally and 3,000 reported deaths, according to the World Health Organization. According to the Australian government, as of the 5th of March, here in Australia, we have 52 confirmed cases of coronavirus, including 2 fatalities. So that's corona. And what we're going to discuss is what does this mean for the world and what does this mean for Australia? And for this first episode of COVIDcast, we have 3 terrific colleagues with whom I'm going to speak. The first is Richard McGregor, Senior Fellow here at the Institute and a world expert on the Chinese Communist Party. Secondly, we have Natasha Kassam, a Research Fellow at the Institute and someone who served as an Australian diplomat in Beijing and elsewhere. And finally, we have Ben Bland, the director of our Southeast Asia program. Welcome, everybody. The first question I'd like to put to all of you for a quick response, starting with you, Richard, is how big a deal is coronavirus for the world, both for the global economy and global politics? Is it a huge deal that's going to have lasting impacts? Is it a big deal? Or is it, in fact, overblown? Is it likely to be a blip in the long run?
Well, I definitely don't think it's overblown. We don't yet know if it's a huge deal. It's a big enough deal, I think. Just a couple of points very quickly. The Chinese economy, 30% of global growth. It's not just countries like Australia that are being hit. All matter. Every country around the world will feel this, and they would have even before it spread to other countries. The second thing, China has been touting its model of governance, is an alternative system of government, if you like, to the United States. That also could take a hit as well, and perhaps we can come back to that. It's maybe a huge deal in this respect. If the US handles it badly, it becomes another case of compare and contrast relative systems of government. And certainly the Chinese are already playing that tune, if you like, saying that they've done extremely well, and let's see now how others go. And of course, finally, it's Australia. China's our biggest trading partner. We also already have a difficult relationship with China, so it's going to hurt us economically and geopolitically as well, with, I think, unforeseen circumstances.
All right. Natasha, what do you think?
I would have to agree with that. I suppose I think of this as a very big deal in the short term, and maybe the jury's still out on the long-term impacts. In the short term, there are absolutely the significant economic and political impacts that Richard mentioned. I also just think about some of the normal things that are supposed to be happening this year and whether they will proceed in the same way. Will you still have huge rallies as a part of a US presidential election if this virus is going everywhere? You know, a lot of normal life has already been disrupted in China, and I think we'll see a lot more of that elsewhere in the world. In the long term, a lot of the issues that Richard pointed to, I see as being very significant. But also, I think the way in which countries work together on problems, the way in which countries work with China on problems, that will shift depending on how we react and respond to this increasingly difficult challenge.
All right. And in terms of big events, of course, it's an Olympic year this year. So that's one of the events that may be disrupted.
Absolutely. And sooner rather than later. So I think there's going to be a lot of short-term disruption adding to what's already happened.
Ben Bland.
Well, I'll try and dissent from my 2 colleagues just to make things a bit interesting. I mean, setting aside the health impact, we don't really have an idea how that's going to go, and I'm not an expert in that, so put that to one side. But if you look at the political impact, You know, we've seen IMF and World Bank meetings cancelled. Maybe the Olympics will be cancelled. The US ASEAN summit in Las Vegas, Trump's special, was cancelled. But so what, right? These things can happen the next year, or maybe the Olympics will have to wait 4 years. Does it actually change the balance of power in the world? I think we may come to realise that actually a lot of these fora don't actually change that much, and that things carry on as normal in some senses politically. The thing I would say is it's a fascinating lens on how the world really works. So, for example, people until recently were talking about the potential for the West to decouple from China. And I think what the coronavirus has shown is that it's so hard that you may cut off your direct flights from China, for example, but everyone else is still connected to China and you're still connected to the rest of the world. So this shows us in a way that we can't decouple in the modern globalized world. One country's problems, especially if it's China's, will very soon be all of our problem, whether we like it or not.
All right, let's focus in on China. I'll start with you, Richard, as an expert on the Chinese Communist Party. How effective has the party state's response been to coronavirus, and what implications does it have for the CCP's rule and for Xi Jinping personally?
Well, I guess the CCP or China's response to the virus is in two parts. At the start, which both, I should say, reflect the strengths and weaknesses of the system at the start, suppression of information in Wuhan and Hubei province, which I guess left not only China but the world flat-footed while the virus began to spread. That was very bad. I hesitate to say locking down in various forms of residential sort of detention hundreds of millions of people is good, but the health experts will tell you that that's a sort of textbook response. In other words, isolate the virus, and there are few countries in the world which could do that. For example, you know, can the US lock down New York and stop people coming and going from there? I would say no. In China, they've locked down Hubei province now for 5 or 6 weeks with minimal civil disruption. Implications for the CCP and Xi Jinping, I hate to be a wimp, it's too early to tell. I do resist this idea that it's China's Chernobyl. That's too neat. China is not like the Soviet Union in the mid-80s. It is a much stronger, more coherent and richer state. But there's no doubt that if it goes on, and if the hit to the economy, the hit to people's incomes continues to be large, I think that gets harder for Xi Jinping. He can mobilise people, he can control the propaganda, but ultimately some of his sheen has got to come off as a result of this.
Natasha, what about China's global position, do you think? I mean, we're used to worrying about a strong China, and now perhaps people are starting to worry more about a weak China. How does it change? Is that, do you agree with that? Do you agree? I mean, it does seem to me that we have come to think of China as a source of capital and labour and influence, and now people are starting to think of China as a source of weakness and vulnerability. Is that going to affect China's position on the world stage? Will it affect their ambitions? Will it affect the way they try to achieve their ambitions?
I do think perhaps at the outset of this crisis, there was a shift in the way that people viewed China, and it was seen as, you know, having suppressed the initial information and having then perhaps overreacted. I think that may have caused some kind of negative views in other countries in the world. I do see that changing right now. In part, it's what Richard mentioned, that perhaps other countries are not dealing with the outbreak as competently as might have been expected. And so by contrast, China is portraying itself to have done a very good job in those early days, even though we know that perhaps it was more mixed as a response. But then you also now have a switch in gear for the propaganda machine in China, where they are talking about sending masks overseas, sending assistance to other countries that need it, talking about these kind of laudable medical achievements that they've made and how they can share that information. They've started dispelling or trying to dispel the idea that the virus came from Wuhan. And so with that shift, I think you have a lot of countries that need help that don't have the healthcare systems to deal with this. And suddenly, maybe China's a helpful ally to them again.
You make an interesting point that it feels like the story about coronavirus is transitioning at the moment, as indeed the virus transitions. And as it spreads, it becomes less of a global less of a China story, more of an Asian story, and more of a global story. Let me come to you, Ben. One country directly to our north, Indonesia, our biggest neighbour, it has only reported, I believe, 2 confirmed cases of coronavirus at the moment. Do you believe that? How concerned should we be about Indonesia, given the thickness of its connections with China and given the state of its public health system?
I think there's definitely a lot of concern. There are people in the scientific community who've done the modelling based on Indonesia's population of more than 260 million people and its connectivity to China, a huge number of inbound tourists to Bali and elsewhere, who think there should be many, many more cases. I think one of the issues in Indonesia has been very few tests carried out so far. Until recently, there was only one lab in Jakarta able to do the testing. Now they're sort of sharing that technology further around the country, so there'll probably be a pickup in cases. But to be fair, there's only been just over 200 cases reported across the whole of Southeast Asia so far, about half of which are in Singapore. So it is possible, but I think Indonesia's health system is quite weak and the government sort of information management is usually not very coordinated. So I think we are right to be a bit concerned, and Indonesia could probably do with some help if things do spiral out of control. But looking at the other countries of the region, it is plausible that they could have that few cases, but there are certainly a lot of question marks.
What about other Southeast Asian countries?
I think it's a concern for the region generally because of their connections to China, particularly those countries that have big inbound tourism, so that would be Malaysia, Philippines, Thailand in particular, and those whose supply chains, their economies are really closely tied through manufacturing into China. So we've already seen several countries bring out economic stimulus packages in Singapore, in Thailand, in Malaysia, and Indonesia's done a small one as well. So they really don't know the scale of the problem yet, but they can see not the disease itself, but the shutdown in response to it impacting their economy, and they've moved quite early to try and keep up a bit of confidence. And they're obviously afraid that as the problem gets much bigger in health terms and potentially in terms of the travel shutdown, that economic impact is going to get much worse.
Let me move the discussion a bit to the question of nationalism versus multilateralism and invite anyone who wants to jump in on this. For the last few years, nationalism has been up on its hind legs. You've had Donald Trump, the President of the United States, talking about America first. You've had other leaders taking up that theme. In fact, you had the Prime Minister in his Lowy lecture, Prime Minister of Australia, Scott Morrison, in his Lowy lecture last year, criticise negative globalism. I wonder if coronavirus will change that, because problems like coronavirus don't have passports, and really the best way to solve them is through international cooperation. There's a terrific article on The Atlantic today called Coronavirus is Exposing the Limits of Populism, and it's written actually by 2 authors that have connections with the Lowy Institute, Tom Wright, who's one of our non-resident fellows, and Kurt Campbell, who was a distinguished international fellow at the Institute a few years ago. And Kurt and Tom say expertise matters, institutions matter. So I guess my question to all of you is, could this be the tipping point for nationalism? Could we see multilateralism and international cooperation come roaring back?
I can jump in first, and I would say that, as Ben said earlier, coronavirus is an interesting lens for the way the world already works. And similarly, I think this particular crisis can be used to argue whichever camp you were already on previously. Mm-hmm. So if you were of the negative globalism type, you look at the World Health Organization that has been criticised throughout this process for being completely beholden to China and not necessarily serving public health in an independent and fair way, and you say the international system is broken. If you are, like our Lowy Institute non-resident fellows, in favour of strong institutions and in favour of multilateralism, you say this is the example that means we all need to work together because viruses have no borders.
What I would say is I think this shows the importance of organisations like the WHO, and it should make us worried that leaders in Australia, in the US, the UK and elsewhere have been talking about doing more independently and doing less in multilaterals. But on the flip side, look at what countries have actually done. Everyone has acted unilaterally and taken different actions in terms of travel bans on different countries, often in defiance of the WHO rules. So it shows both what we should be doing, but then what countries are actually doing, which is really going it alone. So I just see this as an example of something that's probably like to exacerbate that drive towards sovereignty and independence, even though it should be a lesson in multilateral organisations and cooperation.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of both. I think if you look at global international institutions like the WHO, they obviously have a paramount role to play at a time like this. But, you know, institutions are only as strong as they're allowed to be. WHO not only has to sort of pull its punches with China to keep access to the country, it also struggles to raise money. So it's a highly under-resourced institution as well. So that's a problem. I think, though, the issue of the and the position of the WHO and the like is slightly different to the other issues we've talked about that are sort of around at the moment in terms of nationalism and decoupling and the like. I think that people will, yes, they'll realise, yes, we are reliant on China, but I think the result of this will be a greater push for some form of decoupling. I don't think you're ever going to have a completely decoupled global economy, but many private companies, with, I would say, some impetus and push from their governments, particularly in the US, will want to have a more a balanced set of supply chains which are less reliant on China. One of the particular examples we're seeing at the moment is with pharma, where most of the ingredients for generics, for antibiotics and the like, all come from China. I bet that's not going to be the case in 5 to 10 years.
Natasha mentioned earlier one short-term disruption might be to rallies in the US presidential race. So, Richard, as someone who until recently was based in Washington, let me ask you about Corona's likely effect on the presidential race this year. Of course, the President of the United States is a famous germaphobe, so he may not be spending as much time on the rope line as he would otherwise. I think people, most experts probably a few months ago would have said that Mr. Trump was favoured to win the election based on the fact that presidents tend to be re-elected in the US system, and on the few occasions this in the last 100 years when they haven't been, it's been during an economic downturn and the US economy has been doing well. But of course, depending on how coronavirus goes, it may well have significant implications for the US economy. It may slow down the US economy. And also some political commentators, even in the last few days, have said that the anxiety about corona has turned people towards a more steady, experienced expert hand, and perhaps someone like Vice President Biden, or perhaps someone other than President Trump represents that at a time when people are anxious about the coronavirus. What's your sort of top of the head instinct for what effect COVID might have on 2020 presidential election?
Well, potentially very great, and I think the key is in the economy. Trump's the best thing Trump has going for it for him, apart from his sort of strong base or loyal base, is the relative strength of the US economy. Now, Mr. Trump always sees that through the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, as we all know, the US stock market is not a proxy for the real economy, but nonetheless, unemployment is low. You see in some areas wages edging up and the like. And the virus could really hit that. And of course, COVID-19 on the campaign trail might become, in the eyes of Trump, another one of these sort of demons emerging out of the swamp of the deep state, you know, attempting to get Mr. Trump, you know. So I can see the virus becoming a player in the campaign as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, I might finish on a discussion of Australia. Let me give each of you a chance to weigh in on this last question. Australia is an island nation. It's that our geography gives us some advantages in terms of shielding ourselves from external influences, should we wish to. This government has made homeland, and the coalition parties have made homeland security a theme of their politics over many years. And I think most people would say the government took a cautious early approach to coronavirus, and that seems to have been the smart response. So how We're now starting to see some weirdnesses in the Australian media. We're seeing a run on toilet paper at the moment. Impossible to get a roll of toilet paper, regardless of what you're prepared to pay.
Is Lowy well stocked?
Don't worry. We have all sorts of emergency plans in the basement, Richard, so you can relax. You don't need to raid the Bondi Junction Woolies. But let me ask each of you, how do you think Australia has reacted so far? How well placed are we, do you think, as we go into the year of coronavirus? Natasha, I'll start with you.
I do think it's how long is a piece of string. You know, a week ago it seemed like Australia was doing really well. Now the numbers are going up day by day. Mm-hmm. Certainly our government has been cautious, and I think that was the right thing to do. A friend of mine living in China asked me about a month ago why Australia's reaction had been so extreme. And she said to me, even Japan hasn't closed its borders and, you know, they hate China, so why would Australia do that? And, I mean, she was exaggerating to some extent, but a few weeks later she says, oh, maybe Australia made the right decision and, you know, poor Japan. So we've been cautious. That has worked in our favour. But if this becomes a virus that is of epidemic levels in all the countries of the world, I don't think we can close our borders to everyone. So I think the government will be really tested in the period to come rather than to date.
Ben?
Yeah, I think it's still really early days. I would echo what Natasha said. And in the end, you can't cut yourself off. I mean, one interesting thing, in comparison, is with the UK, where they did consider blocking flights from China, but decided not to because they viewed it like the Maginot line, that you can put it up, but people can just go around it, right? And Italy, by contrast, did suspend flights from China, but now it's become the epicenter. So I think sometimes being an island nation can give you a false sense of security that you can control these things. But I just think, given that it's spreading all around the world, in the end, you can't block off access from every country without completely collapsing your economy and really damaging your own citizens' ability to travel freely. So I think there's a limit to what Australia can do differently from other countries.
Richard, final word.
Well, I think, you know, Australia has done pretty well. I think we have 52 collectively confirmed cases, but out of them, actually, we've had 27 people recover. Now, obviously, things are going to get worse, but it depends on how they get worse, relatively speaking. I think in pure domestic politics, the issue in Australia is whether we have a technical recession. It'll be the first in 29 years, and that'll be very damaging for the Morrison government, which is trying to get back on its feet after struggling with the bushfires at Christmas. I think they're the big issues.
They're the big issues, and the toilet paper supply, which
left,
I'm sure...
I left you to go for the...
I'm sure the Morrison government is seized of that. Thank you, Richard McGregor, Ben Bland and Natasha Kassam, for joining me for today's discussion. COVIDcast is a limited edition weekly podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleagues Sam Roggeveen, Maddie Neist and Selena Alvaro for their assistance. Make sure to tune in next week for the next episode of COVIDcast. Thanks.